And welcome to Two Fat Expats. My name is Kirsty Rice. Now, we've been expats for a very, very long time. Long enough that we remember expat life without Google Maps, Instagram, and Facebook buy and sell groups. Let's all just take a moment to remember dial-up internet and handwritten maps. If you call yourself an expat, or maybe you prefer economic immigrant, you might want to join our Facebook group, Two Fat Expats. There's over 40,000 of us there with a wealth of information to be found when it comes to moving all over the world. My podcast partner in crime is Nikki Moffat. Between us, we've lived in Indonesia, Malaysia, Libya, Hong Kong, South Africa, Canada, the US, Qatar, Germany, and Denmark. Okay, let's get started on this week's podcast. How are you, Nikki Moffat? It's probably 6 months into your repatriation, and I know that everybody is busting to sort of hear sort of how it's going, how you're feeling, where you're at. Has it got better or worse? Tell me all about it.
Hello, Kirsty Rice. How are you? Yes, the repatriation roller coaster. I think we did it. It's just like moving countries, we always say, except moving home or to your passport country is a whole different thing. Yeah, I think I'm on the downslope. I was at the top of a tippy top hill and now I'm way down the bottom. It's just feeling really bad and really sorry for myself lately. I'm super lonely. I feel really, really lonely. And I have no friends in my current city. Current, it's not a city at all. That's the whole problem. In my current location.
Now, to put it in perspective, just explain to people, when you moved back, where did you move to? And how big is
okay. it? Okay, so I moved to somewhere that I had never been before, never set eyes on it in my life, and it's a town called Bargara in Queensland. It's about 20 minutes from Bundaberg. If people are familiar with Bundaberg rum, that's where that's made. It's a big sugarcane area. It was sugarcane, now macadamias. That's a long story. And it has officially 8,500 people. I think in the next census that number's going to go up because we have lots and lots of construction going on. It's hashtag so hot right now, Bargara, where I live, but it is still essentially a very, very small country town on the coast.
And you moved there from Copenhagen, which isn't a small town.
No, Copenhagen is, although quite a small capital city for a European country, it's definitely got over a million people going on there. And so there's a lot of people to choose from when you're looking for friends.
Yes. And a lot of people who are looking for friends because there's a big expat population there as well.
Yes. And in Denmark, everyone speaks English. You know, you hear English, native English speakers and all sorts of people speaking English on the streets all the time. It's not, you don't feel at all sort of very gratefully. You don't feel as if you are ever sort of out of your depth language wise or, you know, like in a lot of locations you can feel like that. Copenhagen is not one of those places. Copenhagen is a super cool city. It's known for its design and its sleek lines and it's, you know, it's just, it's a super cool city. And I moved to a rural town in Australia.
And you'd been in quite a few super cool cities. You know, you'd been in Hong Kong, you'd been in Hamburg, you know, you'd been to the States, which allows you access to all sorts of cool places as well, and South Africa, which you love. It kind of feels a little bit like another expat location because you're doing all those things. You're setting up a house, you're getting kids organized in schools, it's all new, you know, you're out there. And I guess there is that level of optimism and familiarity. What do you think it is that kicks in at that 6 months where you do start to feel that terrible loneliness and you're lost? What do you think it is that happens?
Yeah, so I think it is. So I don't discount this in other locations either. Like, it does happen. You have the high and then you have the low.
Yeah.
I think with a repatriation is that you know that this is it. Like, you're not going, you might move somewhere else. Like, we don't intend to live here forever, but you're not going anywhere else after this. Like, this is, you've got to make good with what you've got. I think in other places, you can be lonely and terribly lonely. It's not any less worse, the feeling that you have. But deep, deep down in the bottom of your stomach, you know that, oh, one day you're going to have another chance to do this again, and you might be able to do it differently, and you might be able to, you know, we talk about reinventing yourself when you move to a new place and all that kind of stuff. Whereas here, I think part of the feeling is that I can't. And I don't know if it's a factor of my age. We talk about ages and stages and how where you are in your life also determines how all these things impact you as well. Because should I have had smaller children, I would be swept up in their activities and, yes, you know, parent, mum, friends or whatever that is, or, you know, sitting on the sides of the swimming pool and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Whereas I don't have any children here. And, you know, and my husband and I were working together and, you know, I'm throwing tantrums, and I gave up everything to move to this remote location. You know, that feels like something that everyone has said in another location as well. Right. So it feels like a very globally mobile statement that I, you know, I gave up everything to move here, and, as did he, of course, let's be honest. Mm. But I didn't give him that opportunity because I was having, you know, a bad day. And I need people, and he doesn't need people as much as me. So, you know, I recently went to Sydney. I caught up with a load of my Hong Kong friends, and we had such a lovely time. I was able to see one of their houses I hadn't seen, meet a new boyfriend, you know, catch up on the goss, do all these things. And they have had this ongoing relationship that I haven't had. And I can see that even though we're all still friends and I was just one of the gang, like, they have a different kind of relationship than I had with them. And it's what you don't think about when you leave. You know, we've talked before that we feel like our relationships are crystallized in time and we can pick them up whenever we want. And we can, and we do, but it's still different. And I mean, I didn't feel left out. I could just see that it's different. I was like, oh, they've moved on. I mean, not from me, but, you know, they've moved on from that spot where we all were when, yes, we all lived in the same apartment building in Hong Kong. Yes. Whereas I need to catch up from that spot, you know, and have my own Australia-based things that I know or do or whatever. And I don't have that.
Yes.
And, you know, they did ask me, do you have any friends? And I said, no. And they said, well, you know, you can call us anytime. And I do, like, I am reaching out to all my friends. I do have friends everywhere. Like, I don't have no friends. Don't worry, people, I do have friends. But it's just that I don't have any friends here. And, you know, going for a wine on a Wednesday night or walking down the street and running into someone you know, which in small towns you do all the time, it's just different. It's a different feel. I don't have anyone that I can comfortably do that. Oh, let's go for a walk. You know, this is driving me insane. Like, you know, you text someone, oh, I'm going for a walk. I'll meet you at the surf club and we can, you know, go from there or something. Like, I just don't have any of those people yet. And I'm finding it really hard. I'm just being really brutally honest.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it. I get it. And I think, Nikki, you and I talked about this when I came back to Doha after being away for those couple of years, and just about, yep, everyone we knew had moved, and we moved into this new life in a different location. You know, we'd moved out of our family home that we'd had here. And you're right, if you don't feel like you have a friend, like, that's close by that you can sort of have a drink with or do something, you know, just get out and do something with, particularly because, yep, you're working with your partner all day. We all yes, need,
and we have no other conversation either. Yes. Like, when we talk, it's about what we've done all day. Yes. But having said that, I just want to do point out there's a couple of things. You know, I'm so grateful for things. It's not all doom and gloom. Like, I have been to two funerals that I well, those funerals aren't great, but I was so grateful to be able to go to them. And I know that had I been in overseas in Europe, I would not have been able to fly back for them.
Yes.
And so they're two really important funerals that I was able to go to that I am so grateful, because I just wouldn't have been able to do it. And it made me appreciate being repatriated when I was able to do that, when I was able to book a plane, even though I still had to go on a plane, two planes. But it was possible, and that made me stop and be, you know, I'm not into gratitude journals or anything like that, but I did have a moment where I thought,
I'm lucky.
Yeah, okay. I couldn't have done this before. I'm lucky to be able to do it. Yeah.
And Nikki, what about your husband, Sam? Like, he's gone from corporate life to this job where he's basically a landlord and a fix-it guy and a, you know, what does he call himself?
Where's it? He walks around with a shirt with his name on. That's what I say.
So how is it different for him? How is he coping as opposed to you?
Look, he's fine. He's finding it really refreshing. He was really, you know, he'd had enough of corporate life. He was burnt out, and he realized that. And I'm grateful that he did. And he said, put his hand up and said, no more. And I said, okay, that's fair. So he is really sort of reveling in all these new skills he has. Today he was building a Perspex safety fence at a pool so we can get a new property onto the books, because he knows all the pool certification laws for Queensland, and he's buddies with the local pool certification guy. So, you know, there's all these things that he, skill sets that he has, and now we're laughing, like our feeds and our algorithms are all full of this stuff that we're like, we've never considered before, but now, you know, we're competing about who's got the best vacuum cleaner in their feed and all this kind of stuff. So it's just you know, like, I think he's really he's taken to it like that. And I have said to him, look, I'm really struggling, I'm really, and he says, well, then you have to go away and you have to spend time with your friends. And I said, yes but no, like, I have to going away for a weekend and coming back isn't solving my problem. My problem is I need to find, and I'm very grateful that he says that to me, and he can fill in and do my job, some of my job when I'm not here and whatever, we can fill those gaps. But it's not solving my problem, and that's hard to explain to him. Like, my problem is that I need people here. And he's like, I said, I need people. And he's like, well, go and, you know, go to Sydney and go to Melbourne and go to, and I'm like, no, I need people here. And he's like, well, fix that. And I don't think it's quite that easy as fixing that. So,
yeah,
you know, but he himself he's fine. You know, he loves, he's his mates with all the tradies, and he's messaging them all the time about all these things he finds out. He just thinks that's great. So, what can I tell you? This was his secret life that he always wanted to be. I'm not sure, but anyway.
And so what's different, do you think, in your repatriated life than you thought it would be? How did you see it before you landed?
I think I saw exactly, well, not exactly, because you never can know exactly what it is. I had never been here. I'd never seen the place where we're going to live or anything like that. But, you know, I thought about it being, you know, we're living in a rural town, and that's true. I thought that it would be a lot of work, which it is, but I kind of thought by 6 months I'd have friends, because I usually do. So I think that's the difference for me, is that I haven't lived in a town this small. Even when I was growing up, the town I lived in was bigger than this, even though it was a country town. So I just feel that's really, to me, what's different and what's missing for me, because I haven't been able to do that part of it. I just have, and I don't know, I just feel incapable of it. And then if I think I find a friend, you know, it's such a small town that everyone has an opinion about this person that you might have found to be a friend. So, you know, like, oh, I knew their first husband and I went to, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, oh, it sort of puts me off a bit. Like, I just want to find someone, not who's shiny and new, but, you know, like, who no one has an opinion about, so I can just form my own opinions. You know, because that's usually what you do, right? Like you usually meet people and you have no preconceived ideas or opinions about them because they're all brand new people. They're brand new to you.
Yes.
And I think that that's a little bit what's different here. Everyone's like, you know, if they grew up here, they grew up here and they've been here their whole life and they know everyone. And so it's not that I don't know people and I don't talk to people. I interact with people all day, every day, but I don't have that that buddy, you know, that mate that I'm looking for to do that.
I know what you mean. And to others who maybe don't understand, like I think about it just in my everyday life, just yesterday I met four new people and they were all from different countries. Do you know, I met someone passing through from Portugal who was English, who had a great story to tell about how they'd moved to Portugal and why. I met two new people on the golf course who were, you know, both from different places. And, you know, had different experience. Well, I think it's actually more than that. And that happens every day in your expat life.
Right.
Everyone you exactly. meet is shiny and new. So, yes, I completely understand what you mean. And we live in a world where – so one of the things I did last night with golf is we sort of had a go at playing with this new sort of golf society that, you know, plays on, you know, Tuesday nights or whatever. And I remember one of the things they said is, oh, and if you choose to join us, you know, you get a T-shirt with your name and your country flag underneath it. Do you know, it's just part of their deal. So, you know, people can meet people from different countries and all, you know, see if they have a familiarity or not or, you know, whatever. And, yes, because that is what is so different about this expat life, isn't it, is that you are hankering to go out and other people are also hankering to know about you and where you're from.
Yeah, people want to meet you. People want to meet you. They want to have interaction with you. You know, they want to do all that kind of stuff. And here people are like when I lived in Sydney before I'd ever lived overseas. You know, they've got their friends. They're set. Yep. You know, they live here. Lived here for a long time.
Yes.
You know, it's just, it's really, it's tough. Like you can't push in. I mean, not that I've even really tried to be honest. And, you know, maybe that's part of it. You know, it's a little, just bit, I'm just on a down. And so until my little engine turns up the hill again, you know, and I don't know whether I can do that or whether that's just something my mind's going to have to get around or, you know, what is it that's going to make my little roller coaster go back up again, slowly up the hill. But I just, you know, it's just that everyone's not the same because they're not, because people are so incredibly different. But I just think it's not that it's not exciting. It's just, you just want to find someone that's new. Do you know what I mean? Someone that's, I don't know. I can't really explain it. I'm doing a terrible job. Anyway, that's where I'm at and I don't want to gripe and moan and groan.
One last question. And that's, we haven't talked about the children. So you have two children that have also repatriated in the last couple of years.
Yep.
Just, I guess, in a nutshell, sort of how are they going with it and how has their experience differed from yours?
Yeah, so I think with our elders, they came for nearly a year and then came back to us and it sort of didn't work out and then they came back again and they're at university. So they're having a whole new experience and they don't see it any differently than living in another country, I think. I think they're still going to get to that realization one day that this is the country they're living in, but I just think they're thinking about it as just another new experience. They're at university, there's all these things going on and I think that they're not thinking about beyond that. I think with our daughter, she really did struggle in the beginning, but I think now that she's in her last year of school, as your youngest is, I think she's sort of hitting a stride. But to be fair, like all her friends in the boarding house, most of her closest friends are expats. A lot of them are from Hong Kong. It's just how it's worked out. You know, she didn't set out to do it that way, but, you know, like all the people that she keeps telling me about, one's from Qatar, you know, one's from New Zealand, and then two of the others are from Hong Kong, and that's like her little gang that she hangs out with all the time. And I don't think that was at all deliberate. It's just where you end up finding yourself. So I think that for her, she's still got that little support bubble.
Yes.
And then, you know, we're talking about next year and she's like, oh, I don't know. I don't want to be in Brisbane. It's too, you know, to whatever. And so she's, you know, she's talking about Melbourne, going to University of Melbourne, where she's never been in her life. But she just looks at the pictures and thinks it looks fine. So, I mean, I don't know. I think that they're both on new adventures still, and so I think they don't really have that. They're probably still in that mindset. I think they're happy that I can, yep. you know, tomorrow I'm driving to pick up my son to take them to a dentist appointment. I think they like that. They can just call me and I'll drive and pick them up and whatever. I think they like that side of it. But then my daughter is a bit... Well, if seeing you live here, why aren't you here more often, or why can't you do more for me? Like, that seems like we're a little bit at that stage. But, yeah, no, I think they're still in that stage where it's just like anywhere else for them. But I think it will be a longer process. I'm not really sure, but that's where I think we're at with them. Anyway, Kirsty, that's enough about me. That's a lot. A lot of chat about me. Kirsty, I wanted to ask you a question. So expats is an increasingly loaded word, and now they've gone and made a TV series and called it Expats, you know, based on a book of a similar name. I think what all the Fatarashi who are listening want to know is, have you watched Expats on Amazon Prime, and what did you think?
Okay, yes, it is based on the book The Expatriates by Janet Leigh, which is interesting. I wonder why they changed the word. Is it because expats is more familiar now, you know, that people don't use the word, you know, the expatriates, you know, like they used to? I just want to say this is not a book review because I haven't read the book. I've only watched the television series, but I have watched the entirety of the television series. There are big, big differences between the book and the teleseries, in that the child is stolen from a different country in the book, and the role of Mercy is very, very different, as in she doesn't have this ongoing relationship with her expat lover, etc. So it makes me want to read the book because I feel like maybe the book wouldn't have had perhaps the same expat tropes as the television series felt it needed to have. I had no interest in watching this series because I had all those fears that I always have whenever anyone wants to discuss expat life, and that is usually expat women come out of it looking terrible. They look like these overindulged, privileged women who just all have endless amounts of staff, and the staff, you know.
And money.
Yes, and money and Jimmy Choo shoes and, you know, the whole thing, which... as we all know, that is not the expat life. I think it would have been fairer to maybe call this series Expats in Hong Kong, because those who are expats in North America or in Europe and some parts of Asia would be saying, this is nothing like my life. Like, this does not represent my life. And it doesn't, you know, because there are many different types of expats, like there are different types of people everywhere in the world. Okay, so my initial things were, I thought Nicole Kidman got a really unfair narrative in that a lot of people before this television series was even off the ground, there was a lot of discussion about it because it was filmed during COVID, and the actors and actresses who came in to film Nicole Kidman copped it big time for being in Hong Kong when other people couldn't get in or out. And it was really unfair, and as in it was unfair to local expats that they couldn't come and go, whereas it appeared that the cast and crew of the expats could come and go as they pleased and do what they wanted. But I don't know why, Nikki, I mean, what are your thoughts on it? Why did it just become a Nicole Kidman story and not a story? There were plenty of Western expats in this show.
That's true. But I think there's a lot of Australians in Hong Kong. It's the second largest Australian expat community.
Right.
And I think that that's a big part of it.
Right.
So there are a lot of Australians that were stuck in Hong Kong, even though Nicole Kidman doesn't live in Australia most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was that was why the media picked that up. So the Australian media went for her a lot. And then because she's such a big star, I think that the international media picked it up as well. Mm. Like nobody talked about the other people, as you say, and the concessions that they were given. And I have to say that when it came out on, like it had all the fanfare, and I spent, you know, maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes, but like silently protesting that I wasn't going to watch it because I remembered because I have a lot of friends. I mean, I had a friend in Hong Kong who was at the gym and the next day her trainer was diagnosed with COVID and she was taken to a camp for 3 weeks.
Yes.
And, you know, like taken away from her children and all sorts of things. And it just at the drop of a hat, like there was no Hong Kong was a very tough COVID gig. And I, you know, like and I can see why the publicity happened at the time. As you say, it is unfair to Nicole Kidman, but it was unfair to the people of Hong Kong as well.
Yes, yes. And I'm not saying that as a Nicole Kidman fan because I don't think I am. I am actually so intrigued by Kidman because she's my age, and I think that anyone that's your age, you have a much tighter sort of view of them because you're doing the whole comparison thing. I find it in the same way that I find it incredibly distracting when we have men playing roles where the women that are meant to be their wives are seriously 30 years younger, you know, and it just doesn't match.
Yeah.
In that same way, I just found it difficult because I was thinking you are a 55-year-old playing the role of a mother of a, you know, 5-year-old.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not real. It's a television series. I should get over it. I completely identified with that fear of losing a child while overseas. I think you'd be lying as an expat to not say that it hasn't crossed your mind of it when you've lived in countries where you're not sure if an ambulance would actually come or what would happen if your child disappeared or where you would go and what you would do, because we all arrive in countries not really fully understanding how the system works, and we spend that first couple of years learning how the system works and how to get around. But there is always that underlying fear of what if something went wrong, what would I do?
Yeah, and because you don't learn it, because you don't do it.
Yes.
It just, if it happens to you, you're thrust into it. And that's evident in some parts of the TV series where they have to go and,
yeah. You know, Nikki, I'm working on this series at the moment. It's called 20 Things That You Need to Know Before You Move To. And I've done Abu Dhabi, Bahrain, Cairo, but I've got a whole list of really practical questions, you know. So, you know, what sort of SIM card do you use, you know, which telephone company? But one question I've asked everybody is, what would you do when your car breaks down? And nobody has been able to answer me because they've all been in these places, because I've made it that you can only be there between 2 and 5 years, because I think that's the ultimate of when you're really learning things about a country and you're in that full, you haven't been there too long that you don't know about what's new. But everyone was like, I don't know, I'll have to go back and find out about that, because, you know, if it's not happening to you, you're not thinking about it. And then,
you know, but I bet they all went and did that. And then they all shared it with all their friends and said, well, just so you know, this is what you do. And so I think that you, by asking that question in this yet-to-be-published series, have helped a lot of people in their future, because they have extra piece of information.
So on that, with the identifying the fear of losing a child, one of the things that really hit home for me, and I think they captured it perfectly, is this is not spoiling anything because this is what the whole story is really based around, is Nicole Kidman loses a child in a very busy shopping, you know, outdoor market, and can't find them. But there is then a scene where they're told that a body has been found and that they need to go to a morgue to identify the body. And the body is over on the mainland, and so there is this whole thing where they get up incredibly early, they leave their other two children at home with their helper, and then they go through this whole thing of they get there that early and then it's closed and they can't find their way in. And I identified it with the amount of times I have been in a situation where I've been given instructions and told things to do in many different countries, whether it's been Jakarta, Kuala Lumpur, you know, Tripoli, Malta, wherever, where I've been told you need to be at this building at this time. And you do the whole, I've got to leave my children somewhere while I go and do this because this is not a child-friendly activity. So there's that to get past. Then there's the, I don't know how this works. I don't know if, you know, there's going to be a language problem here. And then you find out that the instructions you've got are not quite right anyway because it's not open yet and you could have come 4 hours later. And then you get in there and you can't converse with the person because you're both speaking different languages. Then you find yourself in a tiny little office. In their case, they get locked into the office because nobody can be bothered dealing with them. They're left there, you're thinking, this is outrageous. Nowhere in my world would I be going through this experience of going to look at a body and be treated with such total indifference. Like you think in your home country, you would be treated with such kid gloves of, we have to look after these people. They've been through such a traumatic experience. We'll have the, you know, we'll go through the counseling, we'll go through the whole thing. But there is none of that. And this is where I think Kidman just plays her role so beautifully, because she's stressed and tired and just completely forlorn. Her husband bursts into tears, but she is just laughing hysterically. And I completely got it, because it was that, this whole thing is so ridiculous. All I can do is laugh, because this makes no sense in the world that I understand. The things that I kind of struggled with is just the whole thing with staff. And, you know, Nikki, I've told you before about, you know, I've been lucky enough to live in countries where I've had help. And I've needed help because I've had no family, I've had young children, I've had a husband that's worked, you know, very long days. I've tried to work at certain times as well. But when we talk about help, it's not, you know, Alice from the Brady Bunch kind of help. It is trying to develop a whole new relationship where you're dealing with learning a new language and discuss things. And, you know, I always joke about how...
And cultural differences.
Yes, and how friends, you know, had green broccoli and white broccoli because they never really learnt the right word for cauliflower. And so white broccoli was just, cauliflower was always white broccoli. And that there is always this sense of, I'm stuffing this up, am I being offensive or am I not being offensive, am I doing whatever, but never ever in the world of staff have I ever given instructions of make me an omelette and have it the way I like it and set the table like this and do this. I mean, that was just out of this world. That is not what help looks like, and it just drove me insane because I was thinking, you know, these are incredibly wealthy people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair, in Hong Kong there are a lot of Filipino helpers, which is what they're called in Hong Kong, and that's who is portrayed. And there is not really a much of a language barrier, to be fair, for that. So
was your helper making your omelette for you every morning? How you like it?
No. She was not, but she was. I look, tropes, I'm in some of them. You know, like I used to say to people, you know, our helper was amazing. I loved her. And I used to say to people, you know, it's like the kids have three parents, but they didn't. Like they just had two parents. But because Sam and I worked all day every day, like Gina was the person that looked after them during the day and fed them and taught them the alphabet and how to count and all that kind of stuff. And I discipline them when they needed to be disciplined. And so I just, you know, I would say things like that. And I cringe now thinking about it. But I know that I meant it at the time because I felt like, you know, it was an amazing experience for us, for Sam and I and our children to have this person in our lives who was so felt like, and you know, it's in the show, part of the family, felt like part of the family, understand not part of the family, but did feel like it. And at the time, because you live together, like you're together all the time, you know, 5 or 6 days a week. So, you know, and you trust your very most precious children to be cared for by this person while you're not there. So, yeah. You know, for large periods of time. So it does feel like that when you get to that point.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, look, I've said things like that and I cringe and I saw things like that. I mean, there's a lot of tropes in this. They tried to get all the things together and throw them all in and make sure we saw them all. You know, but that was there. But for me, just quickly, like I loved Hong Kong, the character. I felt it was just so beautiful and it really made it, for me, it was very you know, it was melancholy and you know, it was, you've said before, it was quite dark. Like the show was quite dark, as in
yes,
the sky and the scenes and it was inside a lot and everything.
Yeah, like you, to me, it felt like you needed to adjust your television to lighten it up because it was so dark on the screen. But yes, but that, I guess they had to do that to give you that feeling of humidity and rain and
the closeness of everything, yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting the way it ended. It was a bright, sunny, sort of lovely Hong Kong day. But yes, throughout the story, when we're getting the darkness of it all, it was a very darkly shot series.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was, to me, you know, there were things that I identified with as having been in Hong Kong. I never lived at the Peak. That was way too fancy for me. But you know, but I know people that lived like that. Like it's not
yes,
unheard of.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, there were things I identified and things I didn't identify with, but there was, like, for example, Nicole Kidman speaks Cantonese quite freely at some stage, and then another stage she's in a supermarket and she can't speak Cantonese. I'm like, well, how does that work? Like, this, she's trying to get corn syrup or whatever.
Yes.
And I was like, that doesn't work, because last week she was speaking quite freely, you know, and I said, note to self, too much Cantonese, because Cantonese is a really hard language to learn.
Yes.
And, you know, you can't just walk in and start jabbering away. Like, it's very hard. So I was like, oh, speaks too much Cantonese. And then I'm like, oh, doesn't speak enough in this next one. So, you know, there were things like that. But there was, you know, like I say, I can speak taxi Cantonese because I can get in a taxi and I can get where I want to go. Well, I used to be able to, but that was like about it. So I had that feeling. I related in a way, but, you know, there were swings and roundabouts with everything. I just, there was so much to love about it in the scenery for me. And, you know, Hong Kong, I felt, was a character in it. The ladies' market, the flower market, you know, the Peak, you know, what they called Kowloon, which was Causeway Bay, I think. But anyway, but, you know, like, so all those kinds of places, yeah, and the Shenzhen even, the whole thing. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I really loved that about it.
Yeah, yeah. But the story itself, so you loved Hong Kong in it, but what did you think of the story itself?
Well, I thought the story itself, I thought that there were, you know, there are a few too many tropes, but, you know, as we said, they do exist. I think that, you know, they changed the story from the book, and I think that the people had a lot of difficulty thinking that a child would go missing in Hong Kong, because Hong Kong always feels like such a safe place, so it feels like it wouldn't have happened there. And I think that was a weakness that, you know, they couldn't. I understand why they did it that way, because they wanted it all to be in one location, etc. But I think it was still a bit hard and not very believable as such, and. Yeah, look, I mean, you have to let go of reality at some point and let yourself go. But when you've lived there and lived that kind of life, like, there are, you know, you're constantly looking for that kind of stuff. So you don't let the story, you know. Look, I understand what you're saying about the child or the missing child. And, you know, when we were expats living in Hong Kong, we would go away with groups of families to Thailand on holiday, and, you know, we would sort of all have different apartments and then meet and have drinks, you know, together at by the pool or whatever. And that was the time that Madeleine McCann went missing in Spain.
Yes.
And so, like, after that, we didn't do that. We all just went, no, this isn't going to work. You know, we'll have to do it another way. You know, just things we weren't considering and things that happened. So I sort of do relate to that side of it. The overall story, I mean, it showed different things. I don't know. I find it hard to detach myself from my experiences in Hong Kong to look objectively at the story, I guess, is my answer.
Yes. Just finally, one other thing. I was very confused by Hillary's character because I didn't understand why her father had acted one way with her family and then a completely different way with another family. Yeah. You know, I think if you're a violent man to one woman, you know, I'm not quite sure why it would suddenly change and you become a great man and a great father. But the one thing I struggled with her is, well, she appeared to have a very senior role in Hong Kong. And for someone that had a very senior role, she had a lot of time. And I just don't think that this is true for most expats in senior roles. And I think the thing about being an expat is you are a worker bee. You have been brought to a location to do a certain job and you are there to do that job. And your contract can get changed at any time. So you might have gone there on a certain deal and then 2 years into it, they say, well, actually that deal's just changed now. We're not going to, you know, pay for this or pay for that or this is going to happen, whatever. So it can be quite stressful in that way. But I think that traditionally most expats work very long days because they're there to fulfill a role and that's why they're there. Do you know, they're not there just because they look pretty.
But that's like every show. I mean, if she had to work all day every day, you couldn't have half the story because she has to be able to go for lunch and do all those things. I mean, I worked in Hong Kong and I couldn't go to the nice lunches and do things like that because I was working. So I do agree with that. Yes, good point. Good point on Hillary.
Okay, so we move on to our three favourite things. Nikki, I watched Past Lives on Amazon Prime. It is an original screenplay that's been made into a movie by C-Line Song, who is a Canadian-Korean. It stars Greta Lee, who is also in The Morning Wars or The Morning Show, depending where you come from. And it kind of follows two childhood friends over the course of 25 years where they contemplate the nature of their relationship. So what I mean by that is they both grow up together in Korea and then one of them immigrates to America as a, I want to say she's probably about 12. And then through the joys of social media and whatever, they connect again in their 20s. And then they eventually meet again, you know, in their 30s. It's actually semi-autobiographical by the author, but it is just the most beautiful story. And I think it will appeal to many expats in that because I've seen people in different chat groups describe it as boring and slow and whatever, but it actually gives you quite the insight into what would have my life been and those friendships where you have where your life changes so much from your travels of what that does to you as people and who wins and who loses and is there such a thing. I thought it was just a beautiful, beautiful story. It was fantastic. I don't know if you've seen it or not.
I have not seen it, but it does appeal to me. So I will be going out to find it.
Also on Amazon Prime, and this is a new one, I don't expect you to have seen it, is American Fiction. Have you heard of this?
I have heard of it, yes. I've seen lots of shorts, but I haven't actually seen it, no.
So 5 Oscar nominations. Jeffrey Wright is the lead actor, and he also received an Oscar nomination. The New York Times described it as a joke that backfires on its author, which is absolutely perfect. So the main character is Thelonious Ellison, and but everyone calls him Monk. And because I'm an uneducated git, I had to go and look up, why are they calling him Monk? Because everybody called him Monk. It's because Thelonious Monk was a popular African-American jazz artist and composer. So that's where the nickname comes from. So Thelonious or Monk specializes in sort of academic reworkings of Greek plays. And he's also black, which means that his work is often misfiled under African-American fiction instead of mythology in bookshops. And it really is all about him trying to make everything not about race, yep. You know, but the world insisting that it's going to be about race. And there's just this continual theme of him being typecast and misunderstood. Anyway, he rebels and decides that he's going to write his own black cliche because he's struggling for cash because of a whole lot of circumstances that go down. And he goes and sees another African-American woman who her name's Sintara Golden, and she's written We Lives in the Ghetto. And so he goes, right, I'm on it. I'm going to write what you all want me to write and do it. And so he writes My Pathology. It's so funny. It's really a movie that's not wanting to write about race. And of course, it ends up being all about writing about race. There's just this excellent scene where he's chosen as a judge on a team of people. There's five of them for a book award, and they're choosing who's going to, you know, which author's going to win this book. And there's five judges, and three of them are white and two are black, and they're deciding which book's going to win. And the three white judges choose this black authored book, and it's full of all these cringy stereotypes. The two black people are objecting fiercely, saying, you know, no, I don't think it does deserve to win. And then one of the white judges justifies her decision by saying, it's time for us to start listening to black voices. And the irony, of course, being that three of those white people that are not listening to the two black voices in the room. Look, it's just a really good reminder of how often we see sort of teen pregnancy or enslavement or gang wars rather than just the everyday lives of African Americans. And I just loved it. It's really well done. I can see why it got so many awards. And he's an excellent, excellent. Anyway, and then my last one is Tiny Beautiful Things. And that's Catherine Hahn stars in that. She was also in Transparent and WandaVision. It's on Disney Plus. Now, you would remember Cheryl Strayed's Wild. That was and so Wild sort of became huge.
That was Reese Witherspoon.
Yes. Yeah. And the book became huge because it was an Oprah's book club book. And then Reese bought the rights to it. But what I had also remembered about Cheryl Strayed is that she then did this collection of sort of essays, and it was Dear Sugar was the name. And what it was is there was like an online magazine called Rumpus, and there was this column that ran from 2009 to 2012, and it was like an agony aunt. And she stayed anonymous for a huge amount of it. And people used to try and guess who it was, who Sugar was. And eventually she came out, you know, on a Valentine's Day one year and said, okay, I'm going to, you know, tell you who I am. So this series is really just a collaboration of all of those essays that she wrote and answers that she did. Each week she's sort of answering different questions, and then her family and her where she is at her life, which is in a bit of a mess, all comes into that. I think it's one of those ones you're going to love or hate. I loved it. She writes beautifully. It's just really well interwoven to the story that someone's written into her own life. I just thought it was just a beautiful way of a reminder that even if you can't help yourself, you can help others. It was lovely. Anyway, that's me. What are yours?
So One Day on Netflix, which I think you've also seen.
Yeah.
It was a 2011 movie with Anne Hathaway that I never, ever saw. Never saw.
Me neither.
But someone in one of my chat groups, put in an article about the 11 reasons why we're in love with One Day and Emma and Dex. And it's because why Gen X is in love. Because it's because it was us. Like in 1988, they were graduating from uni. I was starting uni, but doesn't matter. Like it's the same thing. So the music, the clothes, the technology, the answering machines and the telephones and the, you know, there was no Deliveroo and you had a landline and if you missed a call, that was it. You know, we were using electric typewriters and there was mixtapes and, you know, all that kind of stuff as the same as Dex and Emma. Like, you know, you didn't meet people on the apps, you met them in real life. But the premise of One Day is the same day every year over time and the relationship between Dex and Emma. And I just loved it. I sucked it all up very, very quickly, watched it all and really enjoyed it. And it felt a big dose of nostalgia. It just sort of felt like comfortable.
Yeah, I loved it. I also thought it was beautiful. I thought they were so clever at how they made them younger and older. Because it wasn't like they made them younger and then 60, but they made them 18 to 35. And they did it so well. I loved it too. It's one I could almost watch that again on the plane, I reckon, because it was just.
It's a good one for that. It's just one of those,
The music's great. It's fun.
The music's fantastic.
Lovely. Yeah.
Yeah, no. And you know, everyone has a Dex. You know, everyone can relate to someone who was a Dex. So most people I've talked to about it say, yes, absolutely, 100%.
Yes.
The other one is, so Chat 10 Looks 3 is one of my favorite podcasts. And a recent podcast they did was about a recent trip they did to Hong Kong where they did a podcast. Outrageous that we knew nothing about that. And they sort of did it afterwards. The Australian Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong had them up there and they did a talk up there, and then when they came back, they did a podcast about their visit to Hong Kong. And to me, it was like Expats, but a bit better.
Right.
In that it was them talking about a recent visit to Hong Kong. They talked about sort of how they came across Hong Kong and how Hong Kong felt to them. And I thought that was really interesting, knowing that they're journalists in Australia, but they have both lived as expats, but in different countries, in the UK and the US. And I just liked hearing them talk about it. They did start to review expats, and Annabelle said to Lee, well, the premise is that a child goes missing and it isn't really found. And Lee said, well, that sounds so grim, I never would want to watch that. So that's, they weren't talking it interestingly, they were talking about the premise of it being, so I thought that was also really interesting. Story itself is grim. Like if you don't have a hook into it in terms of the expat side of things, I think it would be hard to watch just for the story, because the story is very grim. So that's it. And my third thing, Kirsty, I'm still wearing my friendship bracelets. I went to the love-in with my leader, with Taylor Swift and 85,000 of my closest friends.
Taylor.
There was Taylor gating. There was all sorts of the Taylor Facebook groups were nuts. Our flights got cancelled at the last minute because of big storms in Sydney, so we had to do a road trip down. It was all very dramatic and it'll be for years to come. But there were hundreds of people driving down and they had pre-planned it and all painted their cars with, you know, Taylor road trip eras tour, you know, honk if you love Taylor, all that kind of stuff. And so there was just, but just being in the stadium, and I know I've seen it in Singapore. I've seen loads of people go in Singapore.
Yes. On all my husband socials. Was in Singapore when she was on.
Did he go?
He said, this is the closest I'm going to get. And he could hear the doof, doof coming out of through the hotel room because he was facing the stadium and could see the lights and everything coming out of the stadium. No, he didn't.
Look,
Nikki, I was going to ask you, because I have totally become a Swiftie, and you know that mine came from the
being a fan of the Kelsey's. Yes.
And so I was more a fan of the Kelsey's, and I used to say I liked Taylor Swift, but I didn't listen to, you know, much of her music, but I didn't find her offensive at all. I just wasn't, you know, it wasn't my bag. But obviously I have younger children, so I absorbed her, you know, through osmosis. But I am now a fully fledged Swiftie, just solely because when she came to Australia, she took over Australia too. And then you start to hear all these stories about her and you start to have a total appreciation of just how amazing this woman is. And then your Instagram feed becomes full of middle-aged men telling you why they've suddenly become Swifties as well, why they think she's amazing. But Nikki, tell me, what are your sort of top two things? What do you find so impressive about her? Like, what are your two favorite tidbits about Taylor that you like to tell people?
Well, I love that she writes so many of her own songs, right? So someone who when I was in Sydney on the weekend and caught up with my friends, my girlfriend, who is a Taylor aficionado, and got no tickets. So it was a very difficult conversation because we had to have the dancing around the room about it. But we were okay in the end. We were okay. But she said, you know, Beyonce has 100 people write her songs. She said Taylor Swift writes her own music. And it's true. And, you know, when Taylor Swift was 16, she wrote the first ever country album written by a woman, a female, and went to the top of the charts. And they said to her, oh, well, that's right. You did write the songs, but really it's about the producing. So the producer was a man. So we can't really say it was, you know, the first album written and produced by a woman. So when she was 19, she wrote it and produced it herself. So no one else could say that. So she has this incredible drive that she has had from such a young age. She constantly reinvents herself. And she, you know, she went from being very country to being so mainstream. The causes that she takes up and just like, yes, there are songs about Jake Gyllenhaal and, you know, All Too Well, 10 Minutes, who can't say all the words. I know you can. You can do all the words to All Too Well, 10 Minutes. But, you know, songs like The Man and You Need to Calm Down. You Need to Calm Down is I love it. I scream it in the car all the time because I just, the words are just, they're so sensible and they're just so, you know, like, but they're like you're having a conversation. You're like, oh, of course that's a song. But to have put that whole song together must have been a very complex situation. It's the opening line, you know, you say it in a tweet, it's a cop-out. And so, you know, like, you need to calm down. You know, it's 7 o'clock, you need to calm down. You know, you're ranting on Twitter at 7 o'clock in the morning, you need to calm down. And, you know, like, you, and then it's about a parade and, you know, Shade Never Made Anyone Less Gay is like a line that everyone in the stadium just like screamed at the top of their lungs.
That's the other thing, isn't it? It's the way her crowd, it is cultish, of that there are certain country claps.
It's 100%
there are certain things you sing. And now I follow all these kooky people that want to know what March 15 is going, what's going to happen, what's going to happen, you know, and just the fact that her fans are so passionate about, oh, my God, I die, you know, that they're just.
Oh, that is the best interview. Oh. The interview on the.
Graham Norton.
Oh, God, what's that? Graham Norton interview. Interview is fantastic, and that clip has been in my Facebook feed for years. Like it just keeps coming up, but it is so fantastic. I died dead. Taylor Swift invited me to her house, and I died dead. You know, like no. But the thing I loved about the concert, just one last thing, is there were so many because Taylor Swift she's 34 and she started when she was 16. So a lot of Gen Y or millennial parents who are in their 30s, late 30s and 40s have children who are, you know, young, you know, getting towards teenagers or whatever, and they would go together and they were just as one, you know, because they both loved all the music and their mothers loved Taylor Swift legitimately because they grew up loving Taylor Swift and they loved Taylor Swift legitimately because they grew up loving Taylor Swift. And just seeing them there together, it was just so much love. Like everyone, there was just so much love and just, it was just so joyful. Like people were just, you know, the security guards and the policemen and everyone was just so happy all the time. Like, you know, there was a little bit of drama, whatever, but it just was amazing. I was so impressed by the whole thing. I didn't hear much of Taylor Swift because I had a lot of people scream, shouting the songs were all around me or whatever. I wore things, but I was very close and I loved every second of it. And I just, you know, and I loved that my, you know, I went with my daughter and she loved it too. You know, she messaged, our seats weren't together because of long story, but she messaged me in the middle of the concert. This is the most amazing thing in my whole life. You know, so she was just like, you know, the whole thing, it was just such an emotional high to have gone. And we were so lucky to have got the tickets because so many people wanted to go and we were lucky to have got the tickets. So, you know, I will never stop raving about her because I think she's amazing. She's a fantastic performer. She performs for 3.5 hours. It's insane. Like, you know, my top 10 songs and a little bit of a story. Like, she does the whole thing and it's incredible. And my girlfriend said, you know, she sings while running on a treadmill to train for her concerts. Like, that's what she does.
Okay, Nikki, we will come back. We won't always speak about repatriation.
No.
But we will come back again to discuss other things.
Absolutely.
But I hope it was a reasonably kind of cathartic experience and that you might feel a little bit better. I don't think I offered any assistance at all. But
no, listening is the main
sometimes
thing.
Sometimes it just helps.
Thanks for listening.
Yes. Okay. All right. Thanks, Nikki. Catch you next time.
Bye-bye.